Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science on the Black Hole Radio Network with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, coming to you live once again from the city of Detroit. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. Today is November 21st. In just a couple more days, we will be participating in some form of another. Our participation will either be for or against, because there truly is no in-between. There is no indifference. The fabricated holiday of Thanksgiving. What I did not want to do this year, as I did last year, was to inundate the audience, the listeners, and the participants of Not So Mad Science with so much detailed information that we become redundant. We begin to repeat the same things over and over and over again. But it is necessary. That we give some explanation to the celebration of the Day of Sorrows, the Day of Pain, the beginning of suffering for our Native American brothers and sisters who lost hundreds of millions with the coming of the pilgrims. To that end, I'm going to share some information with regards to Thanksgiving, and then we'll get into our traditional programming. So, the real Thanksgiving, given from a European perspective.
Horrors of Thanksgiving and America as a white future minority. Coming up.
Far and away, the most massive genocide in the history of the world. The lowest life expectancy in the West. And the year the U.S. will turn native.
Virtually none of Thanksgiving has an ounce of accuracy, and it's the bestseller Lies My Teacher Told Me. The idea of Europe bringing civilization to the Americas simply flips truth on its head. This is what European explorers actually found in North America.
Far and away the most beautiful city on Earth. Five times the size of London or Rome. Great towers and buildings rising from the water. 60,000 gleaming houses, and how spacious and how well built they were. Of beautiful stonework and cedarwood, and the wood of other sweet-scented trees. The many streets and boulevards of the city were so neat and well-swept, despite the multitude of inhabitants, crisscrossed with a complex network of canals, like an enormous Venice, but also remarkable floating gardens that reminded of nowhere else on Earth.
While Europe was drinking water from its polluted city rivers, huge aqueducts transported America's water from fresh springs.
But what impressed most were the special merchant areas where timber and tiles and other building materials were bought and sold, as well as greengrocer streets where one could buy every sort of vegetable, fruits, honeys, nut paste and chocolates. Astonished by the personal cleanliness and hygiene of the colorfully dressed populace and by their extravagant use of soaps, deodorants and breath sweeteners.
Most Europeans never bathed and kept clothes on at all times. The Pilgrims, notes biographer Zini Finer, had a terrible smell. Indians tried, quote, without success, to teach them to bathe. The settlers also had bad breath from rotting teeth. Death and starvation were so common that corpses were just dumped in open pits known as poor holes. Many turned to alcohol and committed suicide. In fact, the story of the first settlers has been deliberately changed, notes author James Lowen, because the truth is so shameful. They actually settled hundreds of miles further south and stayed in America because the mission was a failure. Their real aim, reports historian Robert Beverly, was to find some gold and take it back to Europe.
They spent their days digging random holes in the ground, haplessly looking for gold instead of planting crops. Soon they were starving and digging up putrid Indian corpses to eat. They took some Indian prisoners and forced them to teach the colonists how to farm.
And the meal with the natives wasn't quite the Thanksgiving shown on TV and in school books.
The colonists offered the Indians a toast to eternal friendship, whereupon the chief, his family, advisors, and 200 followers dropped dead of poison.
In mainstream history books, perhaps the most common description of American territory then is virgin land. In fact, notes historian Peter Jennings, it was widowed. Horrific enough, the Nazi ethnic cleansings in Europe during World War II. Leading American studies professor David Stannard notes it's dwarfed by, quote, far and away the most massive act of genocide in the history of the world. The death of 100 million indigenous people in the, quote, American Holocaust. Some from disease, but also vast numbers from a deliberate policy aimed at wiping out the race that mainstream history books continue to pretend never happened. He notes when Heinrich Himmler called the final solution, quote, de-lousing, Himmler was only echoing the Pilgrim Army's rallying cry, Nits make life, Nits being Indian babies. This is a map of Indian nations across the U.S. 80% of the first government's entire budget went on attacking existing Indian settlements to take their developed farmland. The settlers would most probably not have survived, writes Jennings, on their own. 95% of America's entire population was then wiped out. American Holocaust notes there is documented evidence of colonist leaders going town after town, deliberately killing all men, women, and children. Yet school texts and history books remain silent. Orders came from the very top. Under the direct order of George Washington, at least 28 of 30 Seneca towns and all the towns of the Mohawk, Onondaga, and Cayuga were simply obliterated. George Washington wrote, the Indian country, quote, must be destroyed. Thomas Jefferson called to, quote, pursue Indians to extermination. Nobel Peace Prize winner Theodore Roosevelt called beneficial the eradication of the native race. Stannard notes genocide was official public policy. California Governor Peter Burnett in his 1851 message to the legislature.
Extermination must continue to be waged until the Indian becomes extinct.
Another governor issued the public proclamation to, quote, pursue, kill, and destroy all Indians. A witness notes the ensuing bloodbath practically wiped out the native race.
The whites shoot them down like wolves, men, women, and children, wherever they could find them. This war of extermination against the Aborigines is tending to the final extinction of the race.
What reportedly saved the race from extinction was their use of slave labor.
This extermination policy has proved so injurious to the interests of the whites. Indian labor is indispensable.
Highly prized slaves were Indian girls as young as three, said the Marysville Appeal, for fulfilling double roles of labor and of lust. Phil Lane Jr. is hereditary chief of the Hanksonwan First Nation. Phil, really great to see you. What facts are being airbrushed out of history?
Practices were that sometimes you don't want to speak about. And they not only wiped out most of the people, but the way they did it, the greatest loss of people at any time in history.
Cultural genocide is still being waged on surviving Indians, reports Truesell. From the start of the 20th century, children were forced into so-called Indian boarding schools, designed to, quote, kill the Indian in them, according to the system's founding father, Richard Pratt. Indians are obliged to change their name to a Western one like Tom, made to dress and style their hair like whites. Indigenous Americans are also forced to adopt Christianity and all other parts of Western culture. The North Sea Farm witnessed the abuse firsthand. Thank you so much for speaking to us. Can you tell us what happened?
Federal policy here was to was to take the Indian out of the person. They beat the language out of like my father. He grew up his whole life. His hands were kind of bent. As a result, he used to talk our native language, but he never wanted me to learn. I consider myself a recovering Catholic because of, you know, the sexual abuse that I experienced, you know, from the Catholic Church.
Daniel Sheehan says the genocide is continuing. He's helped start the Lakota Child Rescue Project to stop the forcible removal of Indian children. Daniel, thanks a lot for coming on. Could you tell us what is happening to the children?
And what we discovered is that not only were the children being taken on an epidemic level, that it was happening on every single one of the reservations and in virtually every one of the major cities. The International Convention Against Genocide actually has a provision which expressly identifies what's going on as genocide, that the systematic undertaking on the part of the racially dominant culture in a given nation state, taking away indigenous children from their native tribes and putting them in the white culture, has been identified as genocide.
Even the Supreme Court still upholds Native second-class status to this day, writes noted legal scholar Robert Williams. He joins us now. It's really great to speak to you. Can you give us some examples?
One out of three Indian women will be raped during their lifetime. In 86% of those cases, the victims report that it's a non-Indian that perpetuated the sexual assault or the rape. This has been traced directly to the inability of tribes to prosecute these crimes. One of the points I make in my book, Savage Anxieties, is that if you look at the history of the more civilized nations' treatments, so-called more civilized nations' treatments of indigenous peoples, it really makes you wonder who are the savages and who are the more civilized. One very famous study done found that every single treaty that the United States had negotiated with tribes had in fact been breached at one time or another, or had been violated. Supreme Court said they had no property rights and therefore no rights to just compensation. And there was some horrible language in the opinion about how the court recognized that everyone knows that the savage tribes of America were conquered and the treaties were really meaningless anyway. So the perpetuation of these stereotypes in this case, which is still valid law in the United States, it's still a valid precedent.
And so they drink it, but it's actually hairspray.
Native Indians now have the highest rate of suicide and pandemic of cancer in the Western Hemisphere. At 44, life expectancy is lower than Afghanistan and around the same as Europe at the time of the Pilgrims. For an official banquet to celebrate 350 years since Pilgrims landed, authorities invited Native Indian Frank James to speak. When they saw his speech taken from a settler's own account of what really happened, they wouldn't let him read it.
The Pilgrims had hardly explored the shores 4 days before they robbed the graves of my ancestors and stole their corn, wheat, and beans. The Indians knew this fact, yet welcomed and befriended the settlers, little knowing that they would be killed by the settlers' guns. What has happened cannot be changed, but today we work toward a better America, a more Indian America, where people and nature are once again important.
Frank has helped start a national day of mourning each Thanksgiving, a protest over the Plymouth Harbor and Mayflower replica. On the West Coast, thousands also gather for Un-Thanksgiving Day, calling on the U.S. to honor treaties promising Indian rights and international law. The American government faces increasing domestic and international pressure. Supreme Court has reaffirmed the validity of the Treaty of Fort Laramie, giving Indians rights over the area. The United Nations, despite four countries voting against, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States, passed a resolution declaring indigenous people's right to self-rule. The UN is also calling for the states to return to Indian tribes their stolen land. The Mexica movement wants to bring indigenous people of America in a single nation without, it says, the artificial borders created by Europeans. Movement's director, Olentes Galipoca, joins us. Really great to see you. You say the demographics are on your side.
We are projected to be the majority in the states of California and Arizona, and basically the western United States. In the next 50 years, we're going to be the majority in the United States of America. For the European who's scared about all this, I'd say pull a seat over, because that's what we've been doing for 500 years. We've been scared of of all of the monstrosities that Europeans have done to us. They've exterminated 95% of our population. They've stolen 100% of our land. They've left us in poverty on our own land.
Many cities throughout the U.S. are already majority indigenous. In 8 years, eight more states are projected to be white minority. In 30 years, that will apply to the United States as a whole. Reaction of certain Americans is already causing some surprise. Seek truth from facts. This is the truth.
I'd like to say shalom, giving all praise to Yahweh Hashem Yahushua. Also give a double honor to the Elder GMS, and also give a double honor to the Akim, and shalom, and blessings to you brothers and sisters out there that listen to this word, man, and that's growing. As I showed in the clips about Thanksgiving, you know, which celebrates the murder and the slaughter of the indigenous people of this land, the Native American Indians and the Seminole Indians, okay, the tribe of Gad and Reuben, you know. And you have a lot of our people this week that's about to celebrate that nonsense, man. Like I keep saying before, now is a high time to come out of the ways of Babylon. You know, because that's, you're pretty much celebrating your oppression. Because the same thing they did to the Native American Indians is the same thing they did to you Negroes and you Hispanics. Because we all in the same boat. Because we're all a part of the 12 lost tribes of the children of Israel. And now we in the time of our uprising, where the Most High is raising us up, all 12 tribes. That's where you have that standoff over there in Standing Rock, where they want to build a pipeline on the Native American Indians' land. So Thanksgiving is an abominable holiday, okay? Which, like I said before, which I showed in the clip, which they slaughtered those Indians down in Massachusetts, and they celebrated it. And wherever they took down an Indian tribe, they had a celebration. Until Abraham Lincoln consolidated it and made it an official holiday in the 1800s, I believe 1863. All right, so that's what the Bible says this. We go to these scriptures. 2 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 20. You know, Native American Indians, all 12 tribes are going to rise, man. Gad is going to rise. And that's who you Native American Indians are, Gad. Scripture says, Gad, a troop shall overcome, but he shall overcome in the end. Who was the troop? The American cavalry. Okay, all those European settlers, those colonists that took your land unjustly. But in the end, you're going to overcome them. All 12 tribes, we're going to overcome Esau. Who's Esau? The white man. All right? That's why the scripture says Jacob's hand held Esau's heel. Because the Most High is going to use Jacob, our forefather, which Jacob represents all 12 tribes. He's going to use you in this day and time to bring this devil down, man. All right? That's what the scripture says. 2 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 20. And these scriptures are going to cut that wicked, evil holiday. The scripture gives us high holy days that we should follow. And Thanksgiving ain't a part of it. All right? That's celebrating oppression. That's celebrating evil. There we go. 1 Thessalonians 5:22, it says, abstain from all appearance of evil. So the Bible says to refrain, abstain from anything that you see that's evil or contrary to the Most High. Thanksgiving is a part of that. Okay? These holidays, it's time to forget those things, man. It's time to forsake that.
This is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We've got those two perspectives of Thanksgiving. This is how the English see Thanksgiving.
Virtually none of Thanksgiving has has an ounce of accuracy. And that's the bestseller, Lies My Teacher Told Me. The idea of Europe bringing civilization to the Americas simply flips truth on its head. This is what European explorers actually found in North America.
Far and away the most beautiful city on Earth. Five times the size of London or Rome. Great towers and buildings rising from the water. 60,000 gleaming houses, and how spacious and how well built they were. Oh, beautiful stonework and cedarwood, and the wood of other sweet-scented trees. The many streets and boulevards of the city were so neat and well-swept, despite the multitude of inhabitants, crisscrossed with a complex network of canals, like an enormous Venice, but also remarkable floating gardens that reminded of nowhere else on Earth.
While Europe was drinking water from its polluted city rivers, huge aqueducts transported America's water from fresh springs.
But what impressed most were the special merchant areas, where timber and tiles and other building materials were bought and sold, as well as greengrocer streets, where one could buy every sort of vegetable, fruits, honeys, nut paste, and chocolates. Astonished by the personal cleanliness and hygiene of the colorfully dressed populace, and by their extravagant use of soaps, deodorants, and breath sweeteners.
Most Europeans never bathed and kept clothes on at all times. The pilgrims, notes biographer Zini Finer, had a terrible smell. Indians tried, quote, without success, to teach them to bathe. Settlers also had bad breath from rotting teeth. Death and starvation were so common, the corpses were just dumped in open pits known as poorholes. Many turned to alcohol and committed suicide. In fact, the story of the first settlers has been deliberately changed, notes author James Lowen, because the truth was so shameful. They actually settled hundreds of miles further south and stayed in America because the mission was a failure. Their real aim, reports historian Robert Beverly, was to find some gold and take it back to Europe.
They spent their days digging random holes in the ground, aimlessly looking for gold, instead of planting crops. Soon they were starving and digging up putrid Indian corpses to eat. They took some Indian prisoners and forced them to teach the colonists how to farm.
And the meal with the natives wasn't quite the Thanksgiving shown on TV and in school books.
The colonists offered the Indians a toast to eternal friendship, whereupon the chief, his family, advisors, and 200 followers dropped dead of poison.
Mainstream history books, perhaps the most common description of American territory then, is virgin land. In fact, notes historian Peter Jennings, it was widowed, horrific enough the Nazi ethnic cleansings in Europe during World War II. Leading American studies professor David Stannard notes it's dwarfed by, quote, far and away the most massive act of genocide in the history of the world. The death of 100 million indigenous people in the, quote, American Holocaust. Some from disease, but also vast numbers from a deliberate policy aimed at wiping out the race that mainstream history books continue to pretend never happened. He knows when Heinrich Himmler called the final solution, quote, de-lousing, Himmler was only echoing the Pilgrim Army's rallying cry, "Nits make life," nits being Indian babies. This is a map of Indian nations across the U.S. 80% of the first government's entire budget went on attacking existing Indian settlements to take their developed farmland. Settlers would most probably not have survived, writes Jennings, on their own. 95% of America's entire population was then wiped out. American Holocaust notes there is documented evidence of colonist leaders going town after town, deliberately killing all men, women, and children. Yet school texts and history books remain silent. Orders came from the very top. Under the direct order of George Washington, at least 28 of 30 Seneca towns and all the towns of the Mohawk, Onondaga, and Cayuga were simply obliterated. George Washington wrote, the Indian country, quote, must be destroyed. Thomas Jefferson called to, quote, pursue Indians to extermination. Nobel Peace Prize winner Theodore Roosevelt called beneficial the eradication of the native race. Senator's genocide was official public policy. California Governor Peter Burnett in his 1851 message to the legislature.
Extermination must continue to be waged until the Indian becomes extinct.
Another governor issued the public proclamation to, quote, pursue, kill, and destroy all Indians. A witness notes the ensuing bloodbath practically wiped out the native race.
The whites shoot them down like wolves, men, women, and children, wherever they could find them. This war of extermination against the Aborigines is tending to the final extinction of the race.
What reportedly saved the race from extinction was their use of slave labor.
This extermination policy has proved so injurious to the interests of the whites. Indian labor is indispensable.
Highly prized slaves were Indian girls as young as 3 that the Marysville appeal for fulfilling double roles of labor and of lust. Julian Jr., hereditary chief of the Hanksomon First Nation. Phil, really great to see you. What facts are being airbrushed out of history?
Practices were that sometimes you don't want to speak about, and they not only wiped out most of the people, but the way they did it, the greatest loss of people at any time in history.
Cultural genocide is still being waged on surviving Indians, reports Truthout. From the start of the 20th century, children were forced into so-called Indian boarding schools, designed to, quote, kill the Indian in them, according to the system's founding father, Richard Pratt. Indians are obliged to change their name to a Western one like Tom, made to dress and style their hair like whites. Indigenous Americans are also forced to adopt Christianity and all other parts of Western culture. The North Sea Farm witnessed the abuse firsthand. Thank you so much for speaking to us. Can you tell us what happened?
Federal policy here was to take the Indian out of the person. They beat the language out of like my father. He grew up his whole life. His hands were kind of bent. As a result, he used to talk our native language, but he never wanted me to learn. I consider myself a recovering Catholic because of, you know, the sexual abuse that I experienced, you know, from the Catholic Church.
Daniel Sheehan says the genocide is continuing. He's helped start the Lakota Child Rescue Project to stop the forcible removal of Indian children. Daniel, thanks a lot for coming on. Could you tell us what is happening to the children?
And what we discovered is that not only were the children being taken on an epidemic level, that it was happening on every single one of the reservations and in virtually every one of the major cities. The International Convention Against Genocide actually has a provision which expressly identifies what's going on as genocide, that the systematic undertaking on the part of the racially dominant cultures in a given nation state, taking away indigenous children from their native tribes and putting them in the white culture, has been identified as genocide.
Even the Supreme Court still upholds Native second-class status to this day, writes noted legal scholar Robert Williams. He joins us now. It's really great to speak to you. Can you give us some examples?
1 out of 3 Indian women will be raped during their lifetime. In 86% of those cases, the victims report that it's a non-Indian perpetuated sexual assault or the rape. This has been traced directly to the inability of tribes to prosecute these crimes. One of the points I make in my book, Savage Anxieties, is that if you look at the history of the more civilized nations' treatment, so-called more civilized nations' treatments of indigenous peoples, it really makes you wonder who are the savages and who are the more civilized. One very famous study done found that every single treaty that the United States had negotiated with tribes had in fact reached at one time or another or had been violated. The Supreme Court said they had no property rights and therefore no rights to just compensation. And there was some horrible language in the opinion about how the court recognized that everyone knows that the savage tribes of America were conquered and the treaties were really meaningless anyway. So the perpetuation of these stereotypes in this case, which is still valid law in the United States, is still a valid precedent.
And so they drink it. But it's actually hairspray.
Native Indians now have the highest rate of suicide and pandemic of cancer in the Western Hemisphere. At 44, life expectancy is lower than Afghanistan and around the same as Europe at the time of the Pilgrims. Foreign official banquet to celebrate 350 years since Pilgrims landed. Authorities invited Native Indian Frank James to speak. When they saw his speech taken from a settler's own account of what really happened, they wouldn't let him read it.
The Pilgrims had hardly explored the shores 4 days before they robbed the graves of my ancestors and stole their corn, wheat, and beans. The Indians knew this fact, yet welcomed and befriended the settlers, little knowing that they would be killed by the settlers' guns. What has happened cannot be changed, but today we work toward a better America, a more Indian America, where people and nature are once again important.
Frank has helped start a national day of mourning each Thanksgiving, a protest over the Plymouth Harbor and Mayflower replica. On the West Coast, thousands also gather for Un-Thanksgiving Day, calling on the U.S. to honor treaties promising Indian rights and international law. The American government faces increasing domestic and international pressure. The Supreme Court has reaffirmed the validity of the Treaty of Fort Laramie, giving Indians rights over the area. The United
shall tremble what?
From the
body and tear the arm with the crown of the head.
What does that part mean? He tears the arm with the crown of the head. The tribe of Gad, the North American Indians, has something called a blood brother ritual, where they would take, they would go to the leader of the tribe and they would cut their arm and mingle their blood together. That was a custom that they had. Read that part again.
And tear the arm with the crown of the head.
And why does it specify the crown of the head? Because the tribe of Gad had an unusual crown that was different than all the kings and leaders of the world. What was their crown? Okay? Their crown was made up of eagle feathers. Okay? Is that it? All I wanted, that's the first 20. Yes, sir. Or the first Chronicles, chapter 12, in verse 8.
And of the Gadites, they separated themselves unto David to the home, to the wilderness, men of might and men of war, fit for the battle.
Fit for the battle.
That could handle shield and buckler.
That could handle shield and buckler.
Whose faces were like the faces of lions.
Whose faces were like the faces of lions. Remember what Moses said about them, okay? Moses said that they would dwell upon the land like lions. When it says here, whose faces were like the faces of lions, what did the North American Indians used to do regarding their faces? Before they went to battle, they would put on what they call war paint, okay? And their faces looked thick, okay? Was that it?
And were as swift as the rolls upon the mountains.
And it says here that the tribe of Gad, which are the North American Indians, were as swift as deer upon what?
Upon the mountains.
Upon the mountains. This tribe was bad. That's why when you examine, the 12 tribes, they were the last tribe to be conquered and overcome. And why they could not do it alone. They had to get the tribe of Judah, the American black you call today, they had to get the tribe of Benjamin, the West Indian black, and the tribe of Issachar, the so-called Mexican, to help them overcome the tribe of speak both English and the Indian dialect with which Hebrew, by the way, and they could converse. And they made peace, and they had turkey and squash, mint cranberry sauce, that all, bull crap, malarkey, and lies. Listen to what I'm talking about. Psalms 49 and 11. Psalms 49 verse 11. Their inward thought is that their house shall continue forever. Who is David talking about when he says their inward thought is that their house shall continue forever? The white man. They believe that they shall explore and seek out new frontiers to dwell where and go where no man has gone before. That's why they create movies like Star Trek and all the Star Wars and all that. But read it again. Their inward thought is that their house shall continue forever. Watch this. And their dwelling places to all generations. Here it comes. They call their land after their own name. They call their land after their own name. They call their land after their own name. When the so-called white man came on this spot, remember, it was not Columbus that came to the mainland, North America. Who was? Who discovered Amerigo Vespucci, an Italian navigator. And after Amerigo Vespucci, derived the name America. Okay, some folks have it translated America. Okay, so he came to this side in 1493, okay, and his name was the name put on this continent over here. Spoken in Deuteronomy 28. So now we've proven to you what has happened, okay? How did this land become known as America? Psalm 49:11. God proved it and showed you it. Deuteronomy 28, verse 15. Listen good.
Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 15. But it shall come to pass.
Don't shut up.
Welcome back, welcome back. This is your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We're talking about Thanksgiving. And aside from the, the ranting and the raving, as we have said on many times, when we partake in the so-called holy days or holidays, that we know what we're participating in and why. To that end, I trust that we've shared some information with regard to Thanksgiving that you find both helpful, truthful, factual, actual, and exceptionally, extraordinarily beneficial to your life and mine. We'll be right back. This is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We'll be right back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Which way is down? What is down? That's the question. Which way is down?
Hey, Vsauce, Michael here, down here. But which way is down? And how much does down weigh? Well, down weighs about 1/100 of a gram per cubic centimeter. It is light and airy, which makes it a great source of insulation and buoyancy for water birds. But if you let go of down, it falls down. So that's which way down is. It's the direction gravity is pulling everything in. Now, for someone on the other side of the Earth, my down is their up, but where are falling things going? Why do things fall? Are they being pushed or pulled? Or is it because of time travel? First things first, let's turn the sun into a black hole. We can do that using Universe Sandbox 2. This simulator will blow your mind. I love it. In fact, I love it so much, I put a code to get the game for free in the current Curiosity Box. If you're not subscribed to the box yet, you are missing out. Okay, look, for the purposes of this video, we want the solar system. And here it is. Notice that everything's moving pretty quickly around the sun. That's because we currently have the game set so that every second that passes for us is 14 days almost in the game. If I change this to 1 second, we're looking at the solar system in real time. You'll notice that it almost looks like it's frozen. Even though the Earth is traveling around the sun at about 30 kilometers per second, it barely appears to be moving. That is how vast space is. Anyway, let's go back to 14 days. I like that motion. Now look at the sun. It is not currently a black hole, but we can change that. What we need to do is compress the sun. So let's lock its mass so that it doesn't change while we make its radius smaller. Let's make its radius as small as we can, and, oh, where'd it go? Well, it's still there, it's just become a black hole. Pretty spooky, but now, let's look at the rest of the solar system. All right, zooming out, and, nothing's changed. I mean, something's changed, it's colder and darker, but nothing's flying off into space or getting sucked in. You see, by shrinking the sun, we didn't change the direction of down for the planets. They're always being pulled by gravity towards its middle, and making it smaller didn't move where the middle was. But also, the strength of that force pulling them to the middle of the sun stayed the same. That gives us a clue as to what down is. The clue is the other thing we didn't change. Mass. Mass is a measure of how hard it is to accelerate something, to change its motion. Now right now, these two balls have zero motion relative to me. Slapping around this hollow plastic ball is pretty easy. But doing the same to this solid steel ball is a lot harder. Now gravity and weight have nothing to do with this. Gravity acts downward, not against my horizontal slapping. Of course, gravity does contribute to friction, but friction works against me when I start moving the ball, but works with me when I stop the ball. And the steel ball is harder to stop than the plastic ball. The difference is mass. The steel ball is more massive. It's more resistant to having its motion changed. Mass is an intrinsic property. It does not depend on what's around or change from place to place. It can sometimes be thought of as the amount of matter something has. Your mass is the same regardless of where you are. On the moon, on Earth, in the middle of intergalactic space floating around. But all of this said, mass does seem to care about what's around. Mass loves company. Things with mass and or energy are attracted together by a force that we call gravity. The feeling of gravity is just you and the Earth being attracted to one another. Now, every portion of an object with mass attracts other portions towards it. The average of all this pulling is an attraction between centers of mass. Giant things like Earth exert an obvious pull, but everything does, even a baseball. These two baseballs are attracted together by their own gravities. Except their masses are so small, the force is minuscule, and it can't overcome friction or push air out of the way. They're never going to come together. But if you put two baseballs 1 meter apart in the middle of empty space where no other forces could act on them, they would literally fall together and collide. It would take 3 days to happen, but it would. Isaac Newton found that the strength of the force bringing two things together is equal to the product of their masses divided by the distance between their centers of mass squared times big G, the gravitational constant. If you make one of two objects more massive or move them closer together, the force will be stronger. And this force of attraction is what we call weight. So mass is intrinsic, whereas weight depends on what's around. Now, a weird thing happens when you weigh yourself on most scales. Weight is a force, but scales display pounds or kilograms, which are units of mass. What's going on is that a scale is activated by a force, any force. It doesn't have to be caused by gravity. The scale then displays what amount of mass near the surface of the Earth would be attracted to the Earth with the force it's detecting. Now, since scales tend to be used on the surface of the Earth by people on which the only force acting is gravity, they tend to not be very far off, but they can be easily tricked, and they further lead to the confusion between mass and weight. Notice that weight is mutual. You are pulled down by Earth with the same force that you pull up on Earth. According to a scale, I weigh 180 pounds on Earth. And the Earth weighs 180 pounds on me. But because the Earth's mass is so much greater than my own, and because the more massive something is, the more it resists being moved, our equal and opposite weight forces accelerate me a lot more than the Earth. If you drop a pencil from a height of 6 feet, the pencil doesn't just fall to the Earth. More precisely, they both come together. They're attracted to each other by equal forces, but the same force moves the pencil a lot more than the Earth. When you let go of the pencil, the Earth is literally pulled up to the pencil by the pencil's own gravity, a distance equal to about 9 trillionths the width of a proton. That same force moves the pencil the remaining distance, which is still pretty much 6 feet. At the height of the International Space Station's orbit, you and Earth are attracted about 10% less than when you're on the surface, about 8.8 times your mass, but not zero. For this reason, weightless astronauts in zero gravity are neither weightless nor in zero gravity. Their weight force fails to bring them and Earth together because they move horizontally so quickly that they fall just as fast as Earth's surface curves away from them. And even though they're experiencing 90% of the gravity you and I are feeling right now, that's why they don't just fly away, there are no forces, called G-forces, to resist their weight, since everything around them is falling too. It's resistance to your weight force, stress, deformation, that is needed for you to feel weight. What astronauts in orbit actually lack is apparent weight. Likewise, a helium balloon has weight. I mean, it's made out of matter. It clearly has mass, so it's attracted to the Earth. Let's try to measure its weight force. Oh. Okay, it has negative apparent weight. That's because its attraction to the Earth is weaker than the buoyant forces from the air around it that push it up. Now, while it moves up, it pushes air molecules down, but they transfer that force widely, not just directly down onto the scale. Buoyant forces are caused by the fact that whenever you are immersed in a fluid, like water or air, molecules lower down are at greater pressure. They're being pressed by the weight of all the molecules above them and are closer to Earth, so they're pulled to it with a stronger force. Now, having greater pressure means they pack a bigger punch when they collide with things. So, horizontally, those collisions cancel out. But vertically, the stronger collisions from below went out, providing lift, a buoyant force. Now, this even happens on your own body. Across its surface area, air lifts you with a force of about 1 newton, which is equal to the weight force of an apple. So if you weighed yourself in a vacuum, you would weigh about this much more. But that's not all. Earth's spin causes it to bulge at the equator. So the closer you are to it, the further you are from Earth's center of mass, and the less your actual gravitational weight will be. Down is always changing. I mean, where is Earth's center of mass? It would always be the same as Earth's geometric middle if Earth's composition was uniform, but Earth contains pockets of massive rock at different depths, water, mountains. It's got moving, changing insides and air and seasonal ice. And though they're far away, gravity extends forever from everything. So the moon, the sun, the planets, all of them pull on you negligibly, but truly. You weigh about a millionth of your weight less when the moon is directly above you. This chunky, shifting balance of material on Earth and everywhere else in the universe means that down is always changing. On top of that, Earth's spin skews what you consider the direction of down away from its center of mass, because the push you get from Earth's spin seems to slightly lift you, reducing your apparent weight and bending down towards the equator. The net result is an apparent weight reduction at the equator of about 0.5%. If a scale guesses your mass must be 200 pounds at the poles, it'll guess that you're 199 at the equator. The 9.8 multiplier used so often in physics is calculated based on how these factors affect someone at 45 degrees latitude. All of these influences on the direction of down result in a total vertical deflection that's only ever at most a few arc seconds anywhere on Earth. That's not enough to be felt, but changes in direction and strength can be used to study the shape of the seafloor, determine what's under you, or even help you discover ancient buried rooms. Point is, all of our downs aren't a bunch of radially symmetric lines. Down is an uncombed mess. Now, since solids don't flow, they can have shapes that don't pay much mind to this. But water can flow. So, ignoring influences like wind and tides, the surface of oceans and lakes and puddles is always perpendicular to down. If water could pass through land, or if Earth were submerged in water, gravity would be the same everywhere along its bumpy surface. Such a surface is called a geoid, and can be drawn at any altitude. If you wanted to build a table that completely enclosed the Earth, it would have to have rolling undulations, nearly 100 meters at some points, in order to be level, so that a ball placed anywhere on it wouldn't roll. Here is Earth's geoid exaggerated 1,000 times. You'd weigh about 0.1% less, a few grams, here than you would, say, here, where gravity is a bit stronger. Point is, the strength and direction of down is variable by location and changes over time. So, down is a fluctuating vector. Easy enough. Except, why should matter attract matter in the first place? Isaac Newton was able to describe attraction, but not explain it. Humanity got closer, however, when Albert Einstein introduced his general theory of relativity. Einstein thought a lot about the fact that everything falls to the ground at the same rate. No matter how massive something is, when dropped, it will accelerate towards the Earth down, gaining about 9.8 meters per second for every second that it falls. That means that a hammer, that's quite massive, and a not-so-massive feather when dropped from the same height, will hit the ground at the same time. Okay, what just happened was an error. In order to fall through air, a thing has to push air out of the way. But if it has a large surface area and a low weight force, it will have a lot of air to move, but won't be able to move that air very quickly. In a vacuum, things do fall at the same rate regardless of mass. This was famously demonstrated by Apollo 15 Commander David Scott on the moon.
And I'll drop the two of them here, and hopefully they'll hit the ground at the same time. How about that?
That's weird, right? I mean, if a more massive object is pulled with a greater force, shouldn't it fall faster? Well, Newton's explanation was simple. Larger masses are attracted with greater forces, but will also require more force to be accelerated the same as a less massive thing. Something 100 times more massive might require 100 times the force, but it will be pulled by gravity 100 times more. So everything falls to Earth at the same rate. What a fun coincidence, right? Maybe not. Einstein realized that there's another way for things to appear to fall together regardless of their masses. Imagine a feather and a hammer floating in space, in a room. If the room is suddenly accelerated up at 9.8 meters per second squared, the feather and the hammer will hit the floor at the same time. Furthermore, whether it's the room coming up to meet them or gravity being suddenly switched on, neither object will feel any force pushing them. There's no way to tell which of these happened. This is Einstein's famous equivalence principle. He once admitted that his greatest thought ever was that of a man falling off of a roof. While falling, the man would not feel any forces on him, even though he's speeding up. Free fall is indistinguishable from floating alone in space, from having no forces on you, from not being moved. What if gravity isn't a force at all? What if things fall not because they're being pushed or pulled, but because they're not being pushed or pulled? To see how this could be, we need to talk about straight lines. What I have here is a retractable ID badge holder. This is a great way to test for straight paths because the string is always kept taut. The card I have behind has two lines drawn on it, and if, while I pull the string out, it always stays between those two lines, I will know that I never turned while I pulled it, because any turn will translate into a different angle between the lines on the card and the string. Now, if I put two of these on a flat table and pull them out, always ensuring that they go straight ahead, they will never meet. They will be forever parallel. But now, let's put them on a sphere, a curved surface. Again, I pull both strings forward, making sure that they always are pulled out straight, no turning. Wait, they came together. Well, they didn't turn. Look, maybe there's some kind of weird force that pulled my hands together. And just like gravity, I didn't feel it, but it happened. No. What happened was not the result of a force. It was just a natural result of curvature. You might be thinking, wait a second, are those really straight lines? I mean, they don't look that straight to me. Also, what if they'd just moved along latitude lines? Then they'd never come together, and those look pretty darn straight. But they're not. A straight line never turns. And although latitude lines look straight at first glance, following one requires turning. To find straight line paths on surfaces, whether they're flat like this or curved, I love the ribbon test. Now, you can use an actual ribbon, but I have found that a strip of paper works even better. Let's take a look at this path right here. It's straight at first, but then it curves. Now, if two people are traveling along this curve and they want to stay together, the person on the inside will have to cover a shorter distance than the person on the outside. Since both sides of this strip of paper cannot change their lengths, they'll help us find a straight path. If the strip of paper can lay flat, we'll know that we have found a straight line. And as you can see, the strip can lay flat and follow the straight part of this path. But when it comes to the curve, in order to follow the path now, the strip Well, it has too much material on the inside, and that material bunches up and leaves the plane. Therefore, we know that this part of the path is not straight. Let's use the ribbon test to find straight lines on the surface of a cone. Well, from the looks of it, a line directly from the base to the tip seems like it would be straight, and sure enough, yeah, the ribbon lays flat on that path. But what about a ring around the cone? Nope, doesn't work. Shorter distances around nearer the tip of the cone mean that there's too much ribbon up at the top, so it doesn't lay flat. Let's see, what else is there, though, besides this? Well, if I start here and just allow the ribbon to lay flat, I get a little curvy-looking shape like this. I say curvy-looking because while to someone, say, at the base, this path might seem to go up, slow down, change direction, and then fall down faster and faster, since a ribbon on such a path is flat, it's actually, for inhabitants on the cone's surface, perfectly straight. If we trace the ribbon's path onto the cone, we can see this clearly because a cone can be flattened. A straight line on a curved surface is called a geodesic. Here is a geodesic on a sphere. The equator is one. Here's another. A line of latitude is not a geodesic. It's not a straight line. To see why, let's try to follow it with the ribbon. You know what? I have to keep kind of lifting it. Yeah, see, distances around the sphere become shorter as we go up, so there's too much material on the ribbon up here and it leaves the surface. This path contains turns, and in order to turn, a force has to act on you. If no forces did, this is the path you would take. Notice that the ribbon begins moving due east, but then falls south. Falls. Einstein realized that curvature could cause things to be seemingly attracted to one another without needing to invent the existence of forces like gravity. But attraction only happens if things move along the surface. If they stay still, they don't come together. So for something at rest, how does falling begin? I mean, the thing has to move in this direction, but it's at rest, right? Well, yes, but it's only at rest in space, and that's not the whole story. Up, down, forward, backward, and left, right are all you need to describe where an event occurred. But a complete description will also need to describe when. Together, these four dimensions form the setting in which everything in our universe happens. Space-time. Since we can talk about a falling pencil using just one spatial dimension, up and down, we can use a piece of paper to model space-time for it. Okay, so we've got up and down, but we have to add another direction the pencil moves in. Time. Now, if no forces act on the pencil, it won't move through space. It will only get older. And as you can see, if all it does is get older, it won't fall. If space-time was flat, when I let go of the pencil, it wouldn't go anywhere. But now let's allow the Earth, which is massive, to manipulate space-time into, say, a cone. Now, with no forces acting on it, every part of the pencil follows a straight line. But on a cone, as we saw earlier, such a path will look like this. It will fall. This is because distances around the cone are shorter, higher up. Time runs faster, further from a massive object. But to go straight, not turn, every part of the pencil must cover an equal distance in space-time, like this. Only when the pencil hits the Earth does the repulsion of their mutual electrons provide a force pushing the pencil off a geodesic. For the Earth, time is a series of slices from this evolution. The pencil's force-free geodesic is why it falls. Not a push or pull, just the pencil's natural tendency to follow a straight line until something acts on it. Now, we only used one dimension of space and one of time, because visualizing our universe's three of space and one of time would take us beyond the limits of what could be shown on paper or screens. But math can take us there. General relativity allows us to calculate how much mass and energy curve space-time, and has been used to explain things that Newton's older theory of falling as the result of forces couldn't, like anomalies in the orbit of Mercury, which orbits nearest the Sun and is therefore most affected by the Sun's grip on space-time. Many other experiments have confirmed general relativity's picture of the universe, fitting the conclusion that there is no gravity. There's just space-time, its curvature, and us in it. As John Wheeler famously put it, space-time grips mass, telling it how to move. Mass grips space-time, telling it how to curve. Relative to the Earth, we don't move very fast. Even jet airplanes move negligibly close to the speed of light. So relative to Earth, we move almost exclusively through time. As such, we are more affected by the way time is curved by mass than how space is curved. This has led many to claim that for the most part, you feel as though you're being pushed into the ground, not because of a force called gravity, but because time is moving faster for your head than for your feet. Down is relative and always changing, but it exists because of and is always in the direction of slower time. Bertrand Russell called this the law of cosmic laziness. Everything is naturally steered towards where time is slowest. We call this falling, going down. So you don't have to keep anything on the down low. Time will take care of that for you. And as always, thanks for watching.
And as always, this is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. As we said earlier, we gave a brief explanation of Thanksgiving and the purpose of that day and how it came about in this pantheon of holidays established here in the United States of America. And we closed out with our more traditional programming with an explanation of what down is. Which brings us to the end of today's program. And as we close out, we'll get back to more traditional programming next week. I will be forwarding out a post via Facebook to all the listeners of Not So Mad Science, hoping that I'll see you and hear from you then. This is Harold Muhammad signing off. Keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith.